It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our country's Civil War from 1861 to 1865 cost the lives of more than 600,000 Americans. Consider that, 600,000 Americans dead from the Civil War, especially when you think about the U.S. population at that time, a tenth of what it is today. And you start to get an idea of why the ripples from that bloody Civil War can be felt even into the present, over 150 years later. Iowa was a young state when the Civil War broke out. I had statehood less than 15 years by 1861 when the war broke out. Iowa statehood gained in 1846. And even though Iowa was a Union state in the Civil War, dozens of Iowa residents fought for the South, for the Confederacy. My guest this hour is an Iowa historian who has spent years researching those Iowans and tells their stories in his new book, Iowa Confederates in the Civil War. My guest in our Des Moines studio, David Conan. Welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on. So many different facets of this book to discuss this hour. You'll be on the entire hour, and we want to reach out to any Civil War buffs, especially in our audience today, to ask questions of David Conan this hour as we explore Iowa during the Civil War. We'll talk about the Confederates, the Iowa residents, and we'll talk about the definition of that as well a little bit later, the Iowans who went to fight in the Civil War on the side of the South, but also talk about Iowa during wartime, during the Civil War. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. David, tell us more about the focus of this book. Who are these men?
These men were Iowa residents who had lived in the state at least 2 years before their Confederate service, no earlier than 1850, and who were at least 13 years old during their Iowa residency. They came from, if you can imagine the state of Iowa being a rectangle in this southeast crescent of the state, that's basically where most of them came from, where they lived before entering the Confederate service.
Mm-hmm. Why that southeast corner?
I'm not sure, but it actually reflects the early population patterns where settlers would, early on when they settled in the territory and then the state of Iowa, mostly they were in that crescent of the state.
Right, and also explains why Iowa City used to be the capital of Iowa, moved to the central part of the state.
That's right.
That would match that population shift from the southeast mm-hmm. to the greater Iowa region, the rectangle, as you referred to it.
That's right.
How did these men, these Iowa Confederates, first capture your attention as a historian?
Well, I actually stumbled over them when I was studying the Grinnell Station of the Iowa Underground Railroad. In studying that, which is fascinating and rich, I learned that on September 1st, 1864, at the end of Iowa's first draft, three Powashee County residents did not report for duty who were drafted. The provost marshal, in Grinnell sent in two deputy marshals to round up the draft deserters, but bushwhackers murdered the deputy marshals. And that made me ask the question, did any Iowans leave the state and serve the Confederacy?
Mm-hmm.
It turns out I've documented 76 men who did just that.
Are you saying that there could possibly be more than 76? You've documented 76. There are
at least
that many. There could have been more.
Yes. I ran out of time. There are our libraries in river cities in Iowa that I just had, and archives that I didn't have the time to go through their newspaper microfilms, for example. And so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's have you set the scene. Take us back over 150 years, 160 years, 170 years in the run-up to the Civil War. What was the country like then? What was going on that eventually led to the outbreak of the Civil War? And in particular, how Iowa came to support the Union cause, was part of the North's, states, free state. It was a free state.
Yeah. My colleague, Ken Liftocht, author of Iowa, the Free Child of the Missouri Compromise, he rightly set Iowa, the territory and the state of Iowa, firmly, squarely in the context of slavery. Slavery was very, very divisive in the country. And in the 1850s, for example, it was starting to really pick up momentum, and the Underground Railroad was becoming strong in Iowa, and very, very controversial. But in other parts of the country as well, emotions were building up. Many Iowa Democrats reached the point where in the 1850s, they just wanted the issue to just settle down and go away. They respected Southerners' rights to own slaves, and there's a tip of the hat in the Constitution that implicitly recognized that, but they wanted the issue to go away, so they applauded the Compromise of 1850. But the issue did not go away, and with the Kansas and Nebraska territories and coming to the fore, and then leaving the settlers to decide whether the territories would be slave or free, this really led to intensified emotions, and the issue just loomed bigger and bigger and bigger.
Mm-hmm. So in the mid 1800s, of course, the South, certainly a lot of slavery there, but in Iowa. What did you find out about the sentiments toward slavery? There were slaveholders even in Iowa in the 1800s, early 1800s, weren't there?
Yes. The amazing, implausible thing is that in the 1840 Iowa Territorial Census, there were 17 slaves listed, and a number of free African Americans, but 17 slaves to I think 11 or 13 slaveholders. Now, Robert Dykstra, who is the historian who wrote Bright Radical Star, he suggests that in Dubuque County, it was in Dubuque County, that only in that county in Iowa Territory were men or women bold enough to raise their hand and tell the census taker, yep, I've got a slave.
Amazing. I wonder if you'd read a passage from your book. We have very prominent people here speaking out on behalf of the Southerners. You've got a section titled, The Son of Former Iowa
Yes.
Governor Goes Bad. A rebel son becomes a campaign issue. This is former Governor Hempstead. Set it up and read a little bit from an early section of your book.
Okay. I will just jump right into this story. Junius L. Hempstead set down the chisel and ran his fingers over the marble contours of the bust. He was reminded that God, on the seventh day, looked at his creation and said, it was good, very good. A Dubuque arts patron was so impressed that he offered to send 18-year-old Junius to Europe to study art. But Junius's father, a realist who had been Iowa's second governor, nixed the idea. Insisting that Junius receive a good civil and military education, he tried unsuccessfully to enroll his son at West Point. Another option appeared. Former Governor Stephen Hempstead and his wife Lavinia, a native of Maryland, would long remember the day that Junius enrolled at the Virginia Military Institute 9 months before Fort Sumter. VMI had a good reputation, and Junius did well in class. Governor Hempstead might not have known that being a cadet meant taking an oath to support Virginia against all of her enemies. Junius later explained that he believed in states' rights to the fullest extent, and he thought every state is a sovereign power privileged to withdraw at will. He quickly identified with Virginia and the Southern cadets. After Virginia seceded, Junius wrote, "Her enemies became mine." Junius and other cadets entered the 5th Virginia Infantry. His service became a campaign issue for his father, who was running for Dubuque County Judge. A newspaper article criticized former Governor Hempstead. The article stated, Governor Hempstead does not believe in the war to put down rebellion. On the contrary, he believes in the war begun by the South to destroy the government, for he has a son in the rebel army fighting against his country. Who knows but that some of our own citizens may have a relative shot by the hand of this rebel son of a disloyal father? Mm. A letter to an editor accused, "That son joined the rebel army and did so with his father's approval." In spite of the uproar, Governor Hempstead was elected county judge.
Mm, interesting. David Conan reading from his book, Iowa Confederates in the Civil War. They're talking about former Governor Stephen Hempstead, the son there. This is really interesting, David, because this is a great example of how, and we hear it so typically from the Civil War, how families were torn apart in some cases.
Yes.
And you have numerous cases in this book, don't you, of divided families, I think is what you call them.
Yes. One out of every four Iowa Confederates had a divided family. That is either a brother or a son in the Union service, mm-hmm. in the Union Army. So 25%, and to me, that's more indicative of a border state.
If you've just joined us, my guest is David Conan, author of Iowa Confederates in the Civil War. In it, he looks at 76 Iowans who fought for the Confederacy. Iowa residents is the way David defines it here, because the definition is very important here, because there are a lot of people. During this time, Iowa is more or less a frontier state, a brand new state in the Union. So we need to think about it in different terms than we have for today.
Yeah.
But you have 76 Iowans, but we have to remind ourselves over 70,000 Iowans fought for the Union cause in the Civil War.
Absolutely. And the existence of these Iowa Confederates doesn't take anything away from Iowa's proud Union heritage.
Mm-hmm. 34 states in February of 1861, that is what the U.S. consisted of, 34 states. Mm-hmm. Seven southern slave states declared to have seceded from the country. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To our south, Missouri was a slave state, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm.
And very divided.
And Missouri also very divided.
Yes.
Tell us about some of the other individuals among these 76 Iowa residents who fought for the Confederacy and the circumstances that led to their joining, I guess, let's say, the other side.
Would you like me to discuss their motives?
Yes, that would be great.
Okay. There were interconnected motives. The most common one, two-thirds of the Iowa Confederates enlisted out of opportunism, often related to earning a living with little regard for principles or consequences. A little less than half enlisted out of familial concerns, often related to loyalty to their birthplace or the birthplace of their father or mother. Smaller group, almost one-third, had a philosophical motive involving, states' rights related to slavery and or an interpretation of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And then there was a minor motive. 4% felt trapped. They felt peer pressure to enlist or were conscripted. But underlying all of these, I think it's helpful to remember that many of these Iowa Confederates were young men and, as is typical with young men, had a love of adventure.
Mm, okay. Let's dig into some of those motives a little bit more. States' rights. What is the argument that the South made for seceding from the Union, which was consisted of 34 states at the time? What was the logic there?
Well, part of the logic is that states had the ability to elect representatives who could choose to have slavery or not, and elect representatives to Congress, to the House of Representatives and the Senate. when that is principally, I think, and also the fact that slavery is recognized in the Constitution before it was amended. Interestingly, when the Southern states, as they were leading up to seceding, each of them were scrupulous about making sure that they followed the mechanisms of democracy, that they made sure that the majority of that people in their states were electing representatives to vote whether or not that state should secede. So they tried to follow the mechanisms of democracy, of representative democracy, in our republic, a representative republic. Now they did not recognize the federal government's. Let me back up. Mm-hmm. They thought that Abraham Lincoln's election was a threat to the institution of slavery, even though Lincoln denied it. And so Southerners were enough Southerners were really, really scared and emotionally keyed up that they elected men who pulled them out of the Union.
Mm-hmm. How much was, could you tell from looking at these 76 Iowa Confederates in the Civil War, was there talk of white supremacy here when we talk about free states and slave states?
Yeah. I only came across that in a small number of Iowa Confederates. One of them was the eldest son of former U.S. Senator George Wallace Jones. And the Jones family is very interesting because when I had mentioned the 1840 territorial census, George Wallace Jones was the largest slave owner in Dubuque. So he owned three slaves, held three human beings in bondage. So his two eldest sons grew up in a household in Iowa that included slaves. At least for a few years they did.
Amazing. Yeah. Tell us more about George Wallace Jones, U.S. Senator,
yeah.
Actually among the first two U.S. senators to represent
yes.
the state of Iowa,
yes.
right? Tell
yes.
us more.
A very interesting, gregarious, charming man who was a lifelong friend of future Confederate President Jefferson Davis.
Jefferson Davis, also a former senator until he became the president of the Confederate States, right?
That's right. That's right. So George Wallace Jones was very interesting, and his eldest son, Charles, shared many of his father's views, but the son, Charles, he had decided in the lead up to the Civil War, he had met a Kentucky belle, and he fell in love, and his future, his fiance, got him to agree that, you know what, I'm going to stay out of this thing. I'm just not going to fight. I'm going to stay out of this. But at the same time, he thought that he really wanted to serve the Confederacy. He wanted to go south and enter the Confederate service. So they got married. Returned in Kentucky, they returned to Dubuque, and this is they returned to Dubuque about 6 months after Fort Sumter, and then Charles's father, George Wallace Jones, was arrested on the basis of letters basically that he had sent to Jefferson Davis as Confederate president, and. So former Senator George Wallace Jones arrested, thrown in prison.
Hmm.
The son, Charles, saw his father's civil liberties being trampled upon, arguably. And at that point, and there were rumors of drafts in Iowa. And so Charles changed his mind, and he and his wife, they pulled the trigger, and they went to Virginia. And Charles shows up at Jefferson Davis's door, asking, hey, can you get me a job in the Confederate Civil Service?
Hmm. And what was his fate in the course of the war and afterwards?
Well, it's a great question. Charles, he worked for the Confederate Treasury, and then he decided, you know what, I really want to be in the Army. So he again turned to Jefferson Davis, who recommended that the son of his esteemed friend, George Wallace Jones, be given this commission. So he became a lieutenant colonel and was on Bushrod R. Johnson's staff, and then was captured at Drury's Bluff and endured great agony as a prisoner of war in a Union POW camp. Mm. Part of the agony was he suffered from Chagres fever, and so it was a recurring, very pestilent form of malaria. It's terrible. And eventually it started to cause his personality to change. And after the war, things had gotten so bad that he entered the insane asylum in Independence and was there for a few different times. Mm-hmm. So he eventually died while he was there in the insane asylum.
And that's indeed what they called them back then, insane
yes.
asylums.
Yes.
Very interesting. You mentioned Fort Sumter a couple of times here. We should make sure we're all aware that the Battle of Fort Sumter was a bombardment of this fort near Charleston, South Carolina. This is what kicked it all off, right?
That's right.
After that bombardment of Fort Sumter, the Civil War began.
Yes.
Went from 1861 to 1865.
That's right.
Abraham Lincoln, of course, the president, throughout the war, freed the slaves in the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yes.
And this was, and we have to remind ourselves, don't we, David, that this war cost the lives of more than 600,000
yes.
Americans. The U.S. at that time, a country, 34 states, only about, 30 million residents, citizens of the United States at that time, right? A tenth of what it is today.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, okay. We'll consider more about what it was like in Iowa during the Civil War when we come back. David Conan is with us, author of Iowa Confederates in the Civil War, 76 Iowa residents who entered the ranks of the Confederate military during the war. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Well, I wish I was in the land of cotton wool, down there I'm not forgot to look away, look away, look away, Dixieland. In Dixie's land where I was born in early on the frosty morning, look away, look away, look away, Dixieland. Well, I wish I was in Dixie, hooray, hooray, in Dixie's.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with David Conan, author of Iowa Confederates in the Civil War. His book tells the story of 76 Iowa residents who entered the ranks of the Confederate military during the U.S. Civil War, 1861 to 1865. Also, some interesting stories and a sense of what the Iowa home front was like during our Civil War in this country. For parents of Confederates, for peace Democrats. We want to talk about who peace Democrats are in just a few minutes. But David Conan, I want to have you tell us about the photo on the cover of your book. You have a soldier there, and you have the Confederate and American flags. Who was this soldier?
Albert H. Newell. He was a young man, a Tennessee resident, who moved to Iowa. Pardon me, with his family when he was just very young, and Albert H. Newell had an uncle and cousins down in Tennessee, and around the time of Fort Sumter, he went down to Tennessee to help out his uncle, and the following year, the Union Army moved into Tennessee, and after Tennessee seceded, of course. And Albert joined up with his cousins and entered the Confederate service. He was captured. He had his photo taken first, then he was captured by the Union Army, was sent to a POW camp. He actually got sick in this POW camp and died after the end of the war. And his sister brought his body back to Danville to bury Albert.
Mm-hmm. And Danville in Iowa, He was not allowed to be buried there, right?
That's what the family story says. And the town fathers reportedly said, not in our hallowed ground. So his sister arranged to have his body buried just outside the lines of the town cemetery. And years later, when the cemetery expanded, the family story says that there was one Memorial Day ceremony that where Albert received more flowers at his grave than anybody else.
Mm-hmm. The fact that the fathers of the town would not allow a rebel soldier,
yeah. Yeah.
even though an Iowa native or an Iowa resident, to be buried in there, really shows you the animosity that existed during the Civil War and even after, years after the Civil War, right?
Yes, that is so true. And this actually had a political component. During the Civil War, the Iowa Republicans so masterfully, successfully demonized peace Democrats as being disloyal that this stigma, this reputation clung to them for decades after the war. Decades after the war, the Young Republican Party actually stayed in power in Iowa for some 50 years, nearly every state office, to the point that around 1900, historian Hubert H. Wubben states that finally a person could say, you know, there could be a good Democrat.
Hmm. So Democrats at this time were seen as for the South, were seen as, and the Republican Party was new. The Whig Party, had pretty much faded away or was on its way out, right?
Yes, it faded away, and that became the nucleus of much of the Republican Party. And I might add that that actually there were war Democrats, and many of them later became Republicans, but even war Democrats had to fight against this smearing of all Democrats as disloyal.
Mm, okay, so we have these two terms, war Democrats and peace Democrats.
Yes.
The war Democrats obviously on the side of the Union, to keep the Union together.
Yes.
Meaning not allow these seven states to secede from the 34-state Union at that time. Mm-hmm. And the peace Democrats, talk a little bit more about them.
They wanted it right from the get-go. The peace Democrats' ideas were, you know what? If you want to restore the Union and reconcile with these southern states, you're going to make your job a lot harder if you use the sword. It will be much, much harder. And then once the war progressed, when the peace Democratic movement started in Iowa started to take off, they wanted to just have an armistice. Let's stop the fighting. Let's talk. Let's see what we can do. Now, historians have pointed out by the first full year of the war, that was probably unrealistic. But they wanted to have peace. Historian Frank L. Clement referred to them as the loyal opposition. And not being disloyal Americans.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to Albert H. Newell, the man, the Confederate, the mm-hmm. Iowa resident, became a Confederate. Mm-hmm. On the cover of your book, you have a number of photos in the book, in the center of this book. I wanted to read a little bit of a letter that you uncovered. Mm-hmm. You said he was captured, but it was interesting, the letter that he wrote, you said to his cousin, he wrote to a cousin.
Yes.
If I may read it, he writes, "I am sorry to say that I've been made a captive. After getting within a mile and a half of Dixie, I was betrayed into the hands of the Yankees. I had, after many hardships, gained the banks of the Tennessee River, stopped to warm my frozen feet and ears, but oh, unhappy stop. You know my dread of prison. I am in the hands of very kind captors. They vow to be my very best friends of all, allow me almost anything I ask." So this is very interesting. You also have a picture in your book of what a POW, this is in the earliest days of photography here.
Yes.
I don't know if this is a daguerreotype or what type from the Library of Congress. Mm-hmm. You have POW camp in Indianapolis. So,
yeah.
many of the Confederates in this book were captured, sent yes. to POW camps. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about those camps?
The camps, north or south, were terrible places. Very, very rough conditions. Very rough. Mm-hmm. It's just a very, very bad experience. In the case of when I read about Junius L. Hempstead, when he was captured, he not only was captured and in a POW camp, but then he was placed, along with many other Confederate officers, directly in the line of fire of Confederate guns, so that they were at risk of being hit by Confederate shells.
And they were using them purposely as a buffer, sort of a shield.
Yes, yes. And retaliation for the Confederates doing essentially the same thing. And and Junius's parents, former Governor Hempstead and his wife, learned of the situation for Junius, and they were frantic. And they started pulling strings. And they had strings to pull, being a former Iowa governor and a very, very heavyweight in the Iowa Democratic Party. They reached out all across the board to try to free their son.
If you just joined us, David Conan is with me, author of Iowa Confederates in the Civil War, the stories of 76 Iowa residents who entered the ranks of the Confederate military during the American Civil War. Let me circle back to the picture on the cover mm-hmm. of Albert.
Mm-hmm.
There. How did you get that picture?
I got it through two of the descendants, Nelda Palmer and Randy Bailey, who sadly are now deceased. But they gave me permission to use this, and another cousin, Jim Williams, kindly let me use this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was that difficult to dig up? Talk a little bit about the research here, the photos, the letters, the articles. Talk a little bit about how many hours and the effort you went to put those in this book.
Very difficult. It took me 11 years working on this component, 6 years on the Iowa Underground Railroad. But when I looked for Iowa Confederates, I was like a human vacuum cleaner, hoovering up sources wherever I could find them. Angry letters to Civil War editors and newspaper editorials were a rich source of clues. Census records and county and town histories helped me establish Iowa residency. Sometimes Iowa Confederates sought appointments or promotions, and I found those letters in their Confederate service records located in the National Archives with digitized copies available for download for a fee from fold3.com. And then lastly, other sources included Iowa Confederates' journals and letters, some of which are held in museum archives across the country.
Mm. Extensive research done there over the course of more than a decade.
Yes.
What would you count as the aspects of this book, David, that represent something new, something that before hadn't been published or found out? What did you discover here?
Well, besides just the existence of Iowa Confederates, I found that in Dubuque, there were three loyal friends of Jefferson Davis. Between them, they contributed 6 Iowa sons to the Confederate Army. I also found routes that men took to go south during the war, and I found a tantalizing witness statement suggesting that a Confederate recruiter was active in Iowa. A witness in a court case claimed that the recruiter in Hilltown in southern Appanoose County stated that he was going to raise a company and give the Union boys hell.
Hmm. And we have to remember at this time that discouraging the recruitment of Union
yes.
soldiers
yes.
in Iowa would have been a crime.
Absolutely. It was even a crime to leave the state without permission after a certain point. Secretary of War Stanton, he passed some pretty draconian rules that, you're exactly right.
So if you're a young man in Iowa at this time, I'm looking this up as we talk, had, I think, 1860, the census in Iowa, almost 700,000 lived in mm-hmm. Iowa. Mm-hmm. By 1870, more than 1 million. So the population is growing rapidly here. But if you're a young man in 1861, you were encouraged to enlist, right? And then by the end of the war, it becomes conscription?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk a little bit more. Well, let's have you circle back and read another passage here.
Okay.
What would you like to read now?
I would like to read a story that I call A Worthy Challenge. The explosion rocked the horse. Shying to get away, it dumped James Ramsey Moore onto the ground. Intense back pain took his breath away. Staggering to his feet, James hobbled after his horse, grabbed its reins, and walked back to his unit. Born in 1835, James Ramsey Moore didn't stand out among the 10 children in a strict Presbyterian family in Pennsylvania. He was a lackluster student at Washington and Jefferson College, where he managed to graduate in 1858. His parents farmed him out to his successful uncle, Dr. Joseph C. Hughes, dean of the College of Physicians and Surgeons in Keokuk, Iowa, where James enrolled and apprenticed in his uncle's private hospital. Every aspect of this life was new. The grueling studies, ministering to patients amid blood and gore, and even the freedom of being away from home. James finally had a challenge worthy of his sweat and tears, and he began to flourish. Family and friends remarked that James's character rapidly developed, and he became studious, self-reliant, manly, and strong in principle and purpose. Buried deep in his work, James little noticed the political turmoil embroiling the country. He might have stayed in Keokuk and completed his medical degree, but an enticing opportunity appeared. He could practice medicine in Mississippi, where his oldest sister and her husband lived. Around the time of Fort Sumter, James alighted to Natchez, Mississippi, a community known for its intelligence and culture. Putting up his shingle, he examined three partially paralyzed patients, a landscaper, a stonemason, and the African-American foreman of a plantation who had not responded to other physicians' treatment. Under James's care, they returned to work.
David Conan, reading from his book, Iowa Confederates in the Civil War. So tell us what was the end of the story that happened to James Ramsey Moore in this case. How did fate treat him?
Well, this promising, vital young man, promising doctor, when he was thrown off the horse when the shell exploded, his bruise turned into a carbuncle and got infected. He contracted typhoid after drinking contaminated water.
Oh, my.
And he died in sweltering heat in Mississippi and was buried in an unmarked grave in Natchez.
Mm. Finally, I want to ask you as a historian and a researcher, David, to talk a little bit about the experience of digging up the information, finding these 76 Iowa residents who entered the ranks of the Confederate military during the Civil War. Talk about that. What drove? I mean, this is so many years you had. What drove you along? What motivated you here? What was the kick you got out of telling this story and doing the research?
Well, when I first stumbled upon Senator George Wallace Jones's eldest son Charles S.D. Jones, I was very fortunate. I had all these questions. I found that the letters between Charles and his father these letters had been captured by the U.S. State Department Secretary Seward. Because the State Department captured them, they had been spying on the Jones family, their correspondence, because they had been captured. The letters are in an archive at the University of Rochester. As I bought copies of the letters, photocopies, and started digging into Charles's life, every single question that I had about his life and his Confederate service and why he did what he did, I found an answer, a plausible answer that was very encouraging. If I had not found some answers right from the get-go, I probably would have just given up because it was such a daunting, arduous task.
Mm-hmm. What were the greatest challenges when you look back on putting this book together? Is there a category of challenges that that really flummoxed you?
Well, one is just stamina. When I went to the the Center for Dubuque History at Loras College. Over the course of 3 days, I spent 25 hours going through microfilms and making copies of microfilms and just being able to keep the eyeballs on those pages and keep scanning as quickly as I could. That was hard. Another challenge is just being able to, once you find a clue, to be able to tease it out and find the answer. For example, I found one clue about an Iowa Confederate that eventually, if you've ever seen a sweater that has a loose piece of yarn, if you start tugging on it, you tug and you tug and you tug.
And you ruin your sweater.
You ruin the sweater, but in this case, it fell into a glorious heap that revealed that the man who I was studying was on the Confederate Honor Roll. That's the Confederacy's highest recognition of valor, distinguished valor in battle. It was the parallel to the Medal of Honor, where many Iowans proudly were received for their distinguished gallantry in battle.
Mm-hmm. I see in the biographical information about you in this book, you are a member of the Sons of Union Veterans and an associate member of Sons of Confederate Veterans.
That's right.
Do you have ancestors who fought in the war on either side?
Yes. One of my great-great-grandfathers was an assistant surgeon in the Union Army. Another great-great-grandfather was in the Ringgold Cavalry in Pennsylvania. And I will mention, too, I would be remiss without saying that I'm also a member of the Des Moines Civil War Roundtable.
Mm-hmm.
And I was grateful that the chairperson, John Liepa, also professor emeritus of history at DMAC, wrote the foreword.
Yes. And what are these organizations doing today, more than 150 years after the end of the Civil War? What are your goals in these organizations?
You know what? I'm a new member of the Sons of Union Veterans, and they do a lot. They do a lot of education. So do Sons of Confederate Veterans. And they really work. A big job of theirs is marking gravestones of veterans from either side and make sure that they're recognized.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, in the course of this research, if you could meet a historical figure from the pages of your book that you wrote about during the time of the Civil War, do you have in mind who it would be? Who would you most likely like to have lunch with, or I guess maybe a picnic on a hillside?
Okay, I would love to have lunch with James H. Williams. He was a Virginia native who moved to Dubuque. He was a lawyer. He was elected to the Iowa General Assembly, a state representative from Dubuque, and then he returned to Virginia, and he met the lovely Cora, and they had an on-again, off-again romance during the war. Later, after the war, they married. He was kind of a man after my own heart.
Uh-huh. And if you would have that lunch, what questions do you think you'd have for him as a historian?
Oh, boy.
It's tough. There's so many questions you could ask him.
Yeah. I think I'd like to say, James, how well did I capture your story? And how well did I capture your romance with Cora that's in my book?
That's a great way to end this conversation. Thank you so much, David Conan, for coming into our studio, author of Iowa Confederates in the Civil War. Interesting read. 76 Iowa residents who entered the ranks of the Confederate military during the American Civil War. Also stories here of the Iowa home front during the war, peace Democrats, war Democrats. It's a fascinating read with a lot of great pictures in here as well. David Conan, thank you for coming into our studio today.
Ben, thank you so much. This was a privilge.
Okay. You take care, and we'll look forward to more historical work from you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Matt Alvarez, and Caitlin Harrop. Help today from Julia DiGiacomo as well. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.